morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started on Senate Judiciary. We have a very full schedule today. I'm going to have a number of members that will be testifying today, so we may be taking some of the testimony out of order to accommodate their schedule so they can maintain their work within the in the building. And we're going to go ahead and start. Let's see. First thing I want to do is tell anyone that's here for Senate Bill 712. 712 is not going to be heard at this point. Senator Starr called this morning, had some type of emergency that required him to leave the building, so he is not available. So if you're here on Senate Bill 712, it is not going to be heard today. We will work with Senator Starr to see whether we reschedule it or not. So if you're here for that, you're more than welcome to stay, but we won't be doing anything on that bill. And then on work sessions, if you're here on Senate Bill 385, it is currently not ready. We're waiting for a physical. It may be ready before we get finished today, but just let you know that there's a possibility we may not get to that bill. Senate Bill 582, that one is not going to be worked today either. Looks like also 387. At this point, we're waiting for a revenue statement. More than likely, we will not get a revenue statement today, but if we do, we will move the bill. But if not, we will have to carry that or move it to another day as well. With that, we're going to start our public hearings. I'm going to start with the one at the top, Senate Bill 347. And counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 347 exempts records of individuals and their family members who seek assistance from domestic violence service providers.
All right. Representative Brewer and Senator Rosenbaum, you all want to start us off? And Representative Barker, can you put it back?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and happy St. Patrick's Day to you all. Look like you're appropriately attired, at least some of you.
We got some green.
and I'm sure all have green in their hearts today. So I am State Representative Diane Rosenbaum from District 21, which is Milwaukee and Southeast and Northeast Portland, and I am here today to support Senate Bill 347. Very pleased to have my co-chief sponsor, Representative Air Brewer, here, and you'll hear from her shortly. Senate Bill 347 is a crucial bill to allow victims of domestic violence to continue to receive the meaningful services that they need without worrying about their safety by virtue of release of their names or personal information. So the bill provides a very narrow exception to the public records law, which is necessary for certain types of domestic violence service centers. Specifically, one that I'm going to talk about in a little more detail is the Gateway Center, which is a new facility that opened in September in Portland and is administered by the City of Portland. So under current law, any public agency, such as this service center we're going to talk about, is subject to public records requests. And for public agencies' domestic violence shelters, this means that any records that are maintained by them that pertain specifically to victims seeking services, shelter services, and the various services that they need could be released as part of a public records request. The Gateway Center is recently opened, as I said, in September, and it's really a remarkable place. In fact, I would commend it to you for a visit if you get a chance once we're out of session. It's a one-stop shop, one of only 60 facilities of this type in the country, where victims of domestic violence and their children can receive a whole range of services that they need to ensure their safety and to address their long-term needs. And it was developed as a collaboration between private providers and between public agencies. So as I said, the City of Portland administers it, and it serves as a hub. It's on transportation lines. It's accessible. It's just a wonderful and welcoming place. And since they opened in September, they've seen an average of 18 people a day for services. They've welcomed more than 800 victims of domestic violence, and more than 70% of those women return for a second visit. But because the Gateway Center currently is unable to track those visits from one day to the next, this compromises their ability to provide the most effective services that they can, and that's why we need this bill. So the bill, as I said, provides a very narrowly crafted exception. It contains a definition of what a domestic violence service or resource center is in the lines 24 through 30 of the bill. I think you'll hear from others about how necessary that is to the day-to-day functioning for Gateway and for other similarly situated service centers, but really ultimately this is about saving lives for women and children. I wanted to also mention that I serve as co-chair of the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, and although this bill came out after we had already adopted our formal package, we are definitely as a group in support of the bill too. So very pleased to appear to you today and happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Representative Katie Eyre Brewer. I'm from House District 29. I'm a big supporter of this bill, obviously, for various reasons. One, it really demonstrates fiscal responsibility when we have a successful private-public partnership as the Gateway Center. That's a working example of it. However, because of that, in delivering services through a collaborative effort, it does put the actual clients of centers like this at risk of not getting the proper treatment they need when they believe they may lack confidentiality. I am a survivor of domestic violence, and I am previously a sexual assault rape crisis counselor. And I know in both cases what's very important, the big thing to give back to victims of these situations is to give them back power piece by piece, little by little. And one of the things is to give them confidentiality if that is important to them. And to most of them, as they work through on their recovery, confidence and being able to keep their story confidential is very important to them. The center needs to be able to track data, as Senator Rosenbaum mentioned. They need to be able to track data, but they're unable to do that if it puts the information of their clients in peril, subject to public disclosure. So this actually will allow the centers to provide better service, to plan better for it, and still meet the needs of their clients. It's a narrow exception right now in the fact that Gateway is the primary center we're talking about, but this will allow other public-private partnerships throughout the state to go on and expand this model, as this model is demonstrating to be successful. Domestic violence is a very systemic problem in our society. I don't need to tell you about it. No one really likes it at all. And with our economy, it's an increasing issue. We have many bills about domestic violence right now that are going through the legislature. Most of these bills focus on the abuser or offender. This is to actually focus on the victims and move them from being a victim to, once again, not just surviving, but thriving. This is a friendly bill, and it's to give some power back to the clients of this center.
All right, thank you. Questions for Rep or the Senator? Senator Cruz.
Thank you very much. I like this bill. I'm just wondering, because we have like a crisis center in Douglas County as well, so you basically have to have a formal private public relationship to have the protections here. I understand what you're looking at Gateway, but I'm wondering if this could have benefits for other entities in other parts of the state that don't have this formal relationship.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cruz, I can't tell you because I'm not familiar with how that specific program works. It's a somewhat unique model that the Gateway Center represents because it has become an umbrella for so many different services and programs that can be accessed at one location that is administered by a governmental entity.
That's the key. It's this one has public oversight or participation, and that's what the public records are going for. And if it's a private, non-profit,
they should already be protected.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It'd be nice to, I mean, I looked at the language and it's vague enough to be flexible. I understand that. It would be nice to maybe get an understanding of the matrix necessary if there's an organization that aren't currently protected, what they might need to do to fall under the umbrella.
Yeah. Why don't we do this? This is only on for public hearing, and so staff will be able to get clarification and make sure. But the way I was briefed on this, the issue is that since there is a public entity that's involved,
right,
that is the issue as compared to it being a private entity that already has these protections based on it's not a governmental, it's not required to for the public records.
I understand that, Mr. Chair. It's just that some of these centers do, some of their resources are in the public realm that they do referrals to, and mm-hmm. I just want to make sure that with the concept of what you're doing, that we can do as much protection for this information in a more global sense if we can. So,
all right.
Thank you.
Okay, why don't we do this? Senator Rosenbaum, if you would be so kind to step back. Representative Brewer, you stayed there. What I'm going to do is I'm going to recess Senate Bill 347. Right now I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 778. And Representative Brewer, I'm going to let you give your testimony on that. I'm also going to call up Ron Wagner. I know that Mr. Wagner's here on a very tight schedule. He needs to get to Portland, and he's made time to make the presentation he needs to make. So if you can get started.
Sure. I was just wondering if Representative Kotek. Okay. I am speaking on a very narrow part of this bill.
Yeah, all I want to do is get your testimony. We're going to come back. We'll put everything else on the record.
Perfect.
What I'm trying to do is get traffic control, because I've got a lot of people who need to be going a lot of different places.
I appreciate that. I've got a vote waiting for me. This is on Senate Bill 778, which is talking about refund anticipation loans. I am talking specifically.
Representative, I hate to do this to you, but I need you to put your name on the record.
Thank you. I'm Representative Katie Air Brewer, House District 29. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is regarding Senate Bill 778, refund anticipation loans provided by tax-preparing entities sometimes have a refund anticipation loan as a supplementary product in addition to preparing of tax returns. I am going to discuss specifically and very narrowly the disclosures that this bill is suggesting be put up there. Typically, someone prepares your tax return, a paid preparer, in fact, is paid, but they are paid through various methods, and tax preparers charge by the, they can charge in various ways. One is by a separate form. This is just solely the preparation of the tax return we're talking about here. They can charge by form. They can charge a flat fee for a certain type of return, either federal or state, or they can charge by their time, an hour is worth X amount of dollars. They can charge in various ways. In addition, when they offer complimentary services such as a refund anticipation loan, they can charge for the loan. They can charge for an interest rate on the loan. They can charge bank fees. They can charge administration fees. They can charge various fees. Specifically, what this bill would do regarding all these various fees is to have it disclosed up front. In the process, what happens is the returns are prepared by the preparer, and then after the returns are prepared, but before they are submitted or released to the taxpayer, then the bill for the tax prep is given, as well as itemization of the various other and here's a refund anticipation loan, and then there's some fees that may or may not be disclosed at that point. They do have truth in lending requirements when they offer a refund anticipation loan, so as long as they meet those, it's given. However, it's after the fact, after the taxpayer has gone in, provided their Social Security number, income information, address, all of that to this tax preparer. So this bill is simply asking for the disclosure of all these fees up front so that consumers know up front what is going to charge them, at least the framework. Not, maybe they don't know the bottom line dollar, because until sometimes a tax practitioner may not know what forms are going to be prepared until they get all the taxpayer's information, but puts this up front for the clients to do. This allows them an informed choice before they disclose all of their personal information to the tax preparer. It also provides, we believe, one of the requirements is that the consumer is also, it's made very clear, that the refund anticipation loan, their participation in it or buying that service is not required in order to get their tax return prepared by that tax preparation firm or entity or individual. So that's all I wanted to discuss and clarify about that.
All right. Thank you. Ron?
Good morning. For the record, my name is Ron Wagner. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Tax Practitioners. I just want to thank Chair Brzezinski for moving this up for us to allow me to get to Portland for an important time up there. The Board of Tax Practitioners is a consumer protection agency. We protect consumers by assuring that anyone who prepares tax returns for a fee is competent and ethical in their business practice. Oregon law requires paid preparers to be licensed by our board. The exception is CPAs and attorneys. Those professionals are governed, of course, by the Board of Accountancy and the Oregon State Bar. As a consumer protection agency, my concern is not only that they are the most competent and ethical tax practitioners in the nation, but that they provide a service to taxpayers that is in the taxpayers' best interest and provide that they provide proper disclosure to the taxpayers. Filing tax returns, of course, is required by law. It's a legal requirement. When a taxpayer believes that their own tax situation is too complicated for them to prepare the return themselves, they choose to solicit the services of a tax professional. By choosing to use a tax professional, they're turning over all their financial and personal information, putting all their trust in this person. Their trust includes not only that their tax return will be prepared accurately, but that they are receiving the best financial advice, that which is to their best benefit. As it's the will of federal legislators, as well as you, our state legislators, to provide financial assistance to lower-income families and individuals, it's hopeful that those who are paid to assist them to complete their tax returns help them receive the largest tax refund that the law allows. Taxpayers should also have available to them, after proper expenses to prepare the return, as much of that tax refund to which they're entitled without incurring unnecessary or excessive expenses. Refund anticipation loans, or RALs as they're referred to, can be a very useful tool for some taxpayers. For those who are unable or who choose not to have bank accounts, or those who have a real need to have access to the funds more quickly than is possible through electronic filing or direct deposit. As a consumer protection agency, I stress that when RALs are offered, it's imperative that full disclosure is provided to the taxpayers. This includes disclosure of the annual percentage rate as defined under federal law, the actual true cost to the taxpayer, and the alternatives available to them by waiting a few days or a given period of time to receive their refund using ELF and or direct deposit. I think to a similar process, and that is of buying a house, where you sit down at closing, you're handed a pile of papers, and they tell you to sign an initial, a stack of papers and documents without really ever knowing or understanding maybe what you're signing, just to meet the disclosure requirements of the title company. And this shouldn't be the same process. It should be spelled that they should understand very well where they're going with that, with any work that is done by the practitioner. I recommend... As a director of the board, I'm in full support of Senate Bill 778 and believe it will provide consumers with protection that they deserve.
All right. Thank you. Questions for Senator Wessett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple. CPAs and tax attorneys are exempted from this bill. Why?
The clients that normally take advantage of the refund anticipation loans are generally lower-income families. Generally, those are people that would... gravitate towards a different tax practitioner group, more of the tax practitioners that are licensed by our boards. Generally, a lower-income person wouldn't go to a CPA. I have chatted with the director of the Board of Accountancy to ask whether this is an issue for them, and to his knowledge, they don't get any complaints, and they don't believe that many CPAs offer refund anticipation loans.
If I might also respond, CPAs have their own ethics, which tend to set very high bar, high bars. We also have our own problem resolution through the Board of Accountancy as well, and we very much do peer pressure in our industry. I can't speak for the attorneys. They would have to speak to that. Well, not that they don't have their own ethics, but, you know, and we do not like an erosion or anything. And when you've heard me in the Ways and Means Committee talk about this, we hold our each other up to very high standards. And if anybody were to be going out and being predatory in any respect, we would not like that. Our own ethics require different behavior. We also have typically what we call a letter of engagement when we enter into service, and that is done up front, where both the CPA firm and the client signs a letter of engagement, and that outlines the fees and, of course, problem disputes and all of that and the methodologies of how those things happen.
Okay, thank you. Second question. Regarding the disclosure in Sub 3 here on page 2, it says, in each location where the licensee conducts business as a facilitator, the licensee shall display in public view. Mm-hmm. So we really don't have a pile of papers that we're going to be signing. We're going to have a wall covered with all these disclosures, apparently, or a blackboard or whatever. I mean, how does it, can you explain to me just how somebody with a complicated tax return would benefit from having all the disclosure forms stuck up on the wall someplace?
Chair Brozanski and Senator Whitsitt, current law requires that when a tax practitioner offers discounts for their services, that they display in public view their basic fee schedule. And so this, I think, kind of piggybacks onto that idea to make sure that when they come into an office that they can see the what the fees will be up front, so that they are posted and available to everyone to see. Does that answer your question? Or
Not really. If you have a complicated tax return, you know, you can have maybe a simple tax return would be a short form 1040. Sure. And a complicated tax return would have depreciation schedules and capital gains, and it's that thick, and you've got maybe have 20 different forms.
Right.
So this law would require that all of the charges for each one of these different forms would be anticipated and put out on the wall?
If I might respond, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsitt. A few different things. They don't always charge by the form. If that's the way that they charge, they can simply say each form is at X rate, if that's how they charge. What this does, it requires the tax prep information to go up front, but it also, and that's in Section 3. In Section 4, it also requires further disclosure at the time of the refund that the consumer applies for the refund application, which is after the return is prepared. The reason for the information to be displayed in public view is so that the consumer understands at the very outset, before they divulge all of their public information, what the billing relationship is going to be.
I understand that. I'm talking about the practicality of a key.
Well, you know what? Most of the clients going in there, first off, every form is out there. And most forms, you won't know the total package, but the time spent on many of these forms for the type of consumer that uses tax practitioners like this, they're not going to be the overly sophisticated tax issues. They're going to be typically, you know, a rental home, maybe a small business, maybe a pass-through entity, partnership or S-corp, something like that, or a W-2 wage earner. And so there'll be all these forms. They potentially could be any of these forms that are required that are out there, and there's a myriad of them. But they, at least it gives them an opportunity, one more opportunity to learn about the billing before they go in to get their return prepared.
No, actually, one further question, and that is the limit on the 36% interest limitation, which on face value seems like it would be a reasonable restraint. However, if the tax anticipation loan is for only months, then that's a 3%, and if the tax, which amounts to 3% in a month. And if you were to That also includes all the charges and fees and everything by your own definition here in the bill. It lumps it all together. So as I read that, and correct me if I'm wrong, if a $300 tax anticipation loan, could the originator could get, receive no more than $9 for promulgating that loan, which would have the effect of just stopping it entirely.
All right.
But who would generate one of these loans for a $9 fee? Would happen.
Chair Porzanski and Senator Wissett, the APR only, and I'm not an expert at that, and I believe you may have testimony that may shed additional light on this. The 36% just refers to those fees that fall under the requirements to be included in the computation of an APR. There are other fees that are also charged for refund anticipation loans that are beyond just those fees that make up the APR.
Hang on a second, folks. Senator Dingfelder is being one of the chief sponsors, and she would like to engage in this little conversation. So,
great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and unfortunately I didn't have a chance to introduce the bill because we sort of jumped right into it, and thank you, Representative, for being a chief co-sponsor on this. We appreciate it. I think it would be helpful just to provide very quick a little bit of background that I think can address Senator Wissett's questions. This bill comes to you from the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force and a whole consortium of groups that we worked several sessions ago on reforming predatory lending in the state of Oregon. We capped predatory lending fees at 36%, so that's where the 36% comes from. It's consistent with current statute. We thought that was fair because for payday loans, check cashing, that was the same percentage that we used. As far as the reason we felt this was the last piece of the predatory lending sort of puzzle that we weren't able to address in several sessions ago, 2007. They all blur together. So that's one of the reasons you see this before you. And regarding the tax preparers, I agree with the representative that it's really geared towards low-income Oregonians who are not going to be looking at that level of sophistication. It's people who are not very proficient at wading through our, even though, 1040 simple form is not that complicated. They may not have done it before. So they are going to institutions to these facilities that are probably going to be a very quick turnaround form. So the reason that we've asked it to be posted, because again, that's consistent with current statute, that's what we required for the payday lenders as well. So it's part of the suite of predatory lending protections. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right, so let me just
Consumer finance. The former consumer finance chair reminded me.
Let me regroup here. We're a little after 9 o'clock. I know Mr. Wagner has a matter up in Portland. He has to leave for us. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Wagner?
Not for Mr. Wagner.
Mr. Wagner, you're free to leave.
Thank you.
And regarding Representative, is this a question for her or something? Okay.
Good, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Representative, are CPAs required to do similar postings in their place of business?
CPAs are not required to do present postings, but CPAs are encouraged to enter into, to provide letters of engagement to typical course of behavior.
So we're creating a double standard. Thank you.
All right. Representative, thank you very much. I'm going to recess this committee, this Bill 778. I'm going to open up a public hearing back on Senate Bill 616. And, Council, why don't you give us the overview? Representative, come on up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 616 allows a court to include animals within the scope of a protective order issued pursuant to the Family Abuse Prevention Act and declares an emergency and is effective on passage. We did receive the -1 amendments at the dais this morning that have not yet been summarized.
All right. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Barker. I'm the state representative from the Beaverton Alloy area, and I'm here in strong support of this bill. This helps protect victims of domestic violence. It removes one more item that the violator can use as a control measure by threatening or actually harming the pets of primarily women. And as I'm sure Dr. Whitson knows, as a veterinarian, some people, a pet is really truly a part of the family. And this is an easy thing for somebody to control by threatening to either harm or kill a pet. And this would give better protections for the people who need support in the domestic violence arena.
All right, thank you. And as one of the chief sponsors as well, I'm also in support of it. I do believe we have an amendment that's going to narrow the definition of what animals will be included, so that we will get to that in due time. Any questions for Representative Barker? Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Sir, I'd just say his attempt at green is really marginal.
Jody Whitson gave that to me this morning. I forgot to bring him.
All right. So at this point, I don't think we have any other members in the house. So with that, and we're going to go back up to our original. Due to the number of people that we have and the number of bills, I'm going to be limiting testimony as necessary. So what we're going to do is go back to reopen Senate Bill 347 at the top. I have a panel of three, and Shannon Callahan, Ellen Osinch, I'm not sure if it's a U or an O, and Martha Strong. I'm going to ask y'all to try to keep your remarks within about 2 minutes. And if you have written testimony, please do not read it. We will read it for ourselves. Just summarize. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Prusansky and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Callahan, and I'm here on behalf of Commissioner Salzman, who most of you met with earlier this week. He'd like me to express his gratitude for taking the time to meet with him. He also submitted a letter of support for Senate Bill 347, and I also wanted to introduce the Portland City Attorney who's been working on this issue, Ellen Osinak, and the Director of the Gateway Center, Martha Strun-Morris. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, Ellen Osinak from the City Attorney's Office. When the Gateway Center was first organizing itself, one of the key issues that we identified was that there was no existing public records exemption that clearly applied to the records that they wished to keep in order to administer their facility, and accordingly, I drafted language that would clearly exempt records of the Gateway Center from public records from requests that were likely inappropriate. That's all I've got. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Good morning, Chair Prusansky and members of the committee. I'm Martha Strun-Morris, the director of the Gateway Center. And as a public walk-in, drop-in center, anybody can find us. And we've invited everybody in the community who's feeling unsafe in their relationship to come and get information and services that they might need to leave abusive relationships. That invitation is being accepted by a lot of members of the community, and most come for 1, 2, 3, 4 visits, either during planning processes or while they're receiving services. And currently, we cannot track those visits from one visit to the next because we can't keep any personal identifying information. I think it would help us serve victims and survivors to be able to keep a little personal identifying information in order to track the services. I also think it would improve our resource and policy development to be able to see the patterns of how services are accessed over time. So I appreciate your consideration of this bill.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions? Thank you very much. The last two people I have scheduled for 347 are Tom Gallagher and LaDonna Burgess. Would y'all please come forward? Is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 347 today? Tom, why don't you go ahead and get us started?
Tom Gallagher, representing newspaper publishers. We come in front of you many times on public records exemptions, most of the time opposing them. When there's an opportunity like this to come in and support one, we're happy to do it. These are the kind of records that shouldn't be available to the general public. We support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And let's see, I have LaDonna Burgess. Is LaDonna not here? Or have you decided not to?
616.
616, okay. Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 347, and we're going to go ahead and reopen up the hearing on Senate Bill 616. And we've already done the overview, so let's see. LaDonna, why don't you go ahead and come forward, and I will bring up with you, let's Scott Bickstead, and Rob, why don't you go ahead and come on up? You probably need to get back to the county. And I don't see Scott. Well, Sharon, you can come on up and testify, and we'll get Scott next.
I'm LaDonna Burgess. I'm the Executive Director of Domestic Violence Resource Center, which is the only domestic violence shelter and service provider in Washington County. And we know, as we're sure that you know, there's a definite link and lots of studies showing that the abuse and the threat of abuse to family pets is very much a part of an abuser's pattern in trying to control and manipulate his family and his partner in particular. In November of 2010, Monica's House, which is our domestic violence shelter, had the opportunity to expand its services and be able to include and accommodate family pets when coming into emergency shelter. This was arrived at by a collaboration of partnerships in our community where kennels were provided and the support services for pets was provided to us. Prior to that, we know that several of our clients who have called us for emergency shelter upon learning that they couldn't bring their family pets and provide shelter and safety for them as well have on occasions declined services because they just couldn't bring themselves to leave their pets and abandon that support mechanism for their family unit. We just this past week had a very stressful and difficult week at Monica's House. That's not uncommon in an emergency domestic violence shelter, but it was by all standards more difficult than most. And what my staff told me is that they found that this very stressful time actually was minimized because we do now have family pets staying at Monica's House and staying with the clients there at shelter, and that the fact that there were pets there not only minimized the stress level for the clients whose pet was with them, but for the clients who actually were there and were able to benefit from having pets on site, and actually even for our staff who benefited by having the comfort of pets and that environment brought to Monica's House. When I hired my current shelter manager, we had already made the decision to expand and include pets in the program, and she was not particularly supportive of this. She's a fabulous advocate and a counselor. She's worked with this population for a long time, but she just didn't see the value in it. She's now one of our truest believers.
I need you to go ahead and wrap up, if you could.
Besides shelter, we do have advocates at the courthouse providing daily services to community members coming in to get FAPAs. And we know from those staff people as well, when pets cannot be addressed in the FAPA order, some clients choose not to follow through with the process. They feel very strongly that the safety and security of their pets and the care and disposition of those pets, the ability to have access to and have those pets addressed in their FAPA order is a very important part of their decision to follow through and take that step toward personal safety.
Great. Thank you very much. Rob first. Okay.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Rob Ovette, Lincoln County District Attorney, here in strong support of this bill. I'll keep it very brief. It's already been said before. This is about power and control, and this bill is important to deny abusers another tool to suppress and perpetuate domestic violence. This is a good bill, deserves your support. I urge you to move the amendments into the bill and do pass it out.
All right, thank you. Sharon?
My name is Sharon Harmon. I'm the director of the Oregon Humane Society in Portland. We are unaffiliated with any other local or national agency. We're strongly in support of this bill. We recognize the link between human interpersonal violence and animal abuse. I'll give you two cases where we were involved to provide forensic services. Hillsborough police called us because the defendant had smacked his girlfriend around, thrown her out of the house, and then threw the puppy against the wall in one case and stomped on a kitten in the other one, both killing these animals. This is about control. This is about abuse. And the victims that are left behind are often four-legged and suffer the same, if not worse, fate. We encourage your support of this bill. My only concern with the Dash 1 amendments is that it says for business purposes, and any pregnant chihuahua could be a business opportunity. I'd like to make sure that someone isn't saying, hey, this is my dog because it's going to have puppies and we're going to sell the puppies, so that makes it a business. That's my concern with it. I'm fine with exempting livestock and commercial animals. We supported that and encouraged in the formation of this bill, but I'm concerned about business purposes being too broad of an exemption for some animals. Thank you for your support.
Senator Wessett.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. First, the first concern I have is on the word animal in there, and it's way too broad. And the I'm not certain that the, like you, I'm not too certain that the amendment actually addresses legally what we want to address there to make sure that domestic animals are not included in that in the law. My second concern is that in the section sub H, that language could be construed, and I need to talk to legislative counsel, but that could be construed as starting down the slippery slope of providing legal rights to animals. In the from the standpoint of, it's in the same section that talks about custody and child support and all that sort of thing. And are we creating animal support? Are we creating animal custody? And if we're doing that, does the animal actually require a legal representation to get its rights? I mean, that's where I'm going with this, and that's what I'm concerned about.
Well, I'm fine, and that's all I can say.
That's it?
All right. Full employment. You know, it's not attorney day. Okay, any other questions on this side? Thank you all very much for coming forward. I have two other people, I believe, that are scheduled to testify on 616, and that's Scott Beckstead and Emily Davidson, or David Solon. I can't tell from the end of it.
Mr. Chair, we have a question. The Dash Ones, whose amendment is this?
We're getting ready to hear about the Dash Ones.
Thank you.
Scott was not in the room when I called his name, so he went to the back of the list.
That's okay.
Yeah, you're here now. All right, Scott, why don't you start off, and that way you can give us a little bit more information as to what the Dash Ones and what you're trying to accomplish.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Beckstead. I'm the Senior Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States. I am a resident of Sutherland, Oregon, constituent of Representative Przonski, where we also have our sanctuary, the Duchess Sanctuary, home to 200 abused and neglected horses. Here today in strong support of Senate Bill 616, the bill that was, in our view, long overdue as a means of giving additional protection to victims of domestic violence. Let me address the Dash 1 amendments. In a conversation that I had with Rebecca Orr from the Oregon Department of Justice, there was apparently some concerns voiced by judges in Eastern Oregon that they feared that they would be litigating commercial livestock disputes in the within the parameters of domestic violence restraining order proceedings. The concern was that that could lend itself to an argument of a fiscal impact. So the Dash 1 amendments basically clarifies that that the animals that we're talking about in this bill are animals that are kept for basically personal protection, companionship, therapy, and service, not animals that are kept for commercial or business or agricultural purposes. Our position on the Dash 1 amendments is that if this serves to address these concerns that have been voiced, then we're for them. Of course, we're also mindful that there are situations where victims may hold animals for commercial purposes that they may have a very close bond to, and that those animals might themselves be targeted. Nevertheless, we, while we supported the original language, we're also in support of the Dash 1 amendments to the extent that they will address those concerns. I also want to point out the materials that were submitted by the Animal Legal Defense Fund, which has conducted a very thorough review of other states, including California, Colorado, Arizona, Tennessee, that passed similar legislation and found no fiscal impact. In fact, Colorado, which of course also has a thriving livestock industry and is a larger state population-wise, has reported no fiscal impact and is managing these proceedings with their existing available resources. The bill really acknowledges the close relationship between domestic violence and animal cruelty. Study after study has shown that that victims of domestic violence may often not avail themselves of help, may not leave abusive relationships for fear of the safety of the animals that they have. We also know, as Mr. Bovet testified, that abusers very often will target animals as a means of keeping their victims in place. Some judges in Oregon have taken the initiative and provided for animals. I know, for example, Senator Whitsitt in your district, the domestic violence community there has worked closely with the judicial the bench in Klamath County to make sure that animals are taken care of. But we've also received anecdotal accounts of judges in other parts of the state that have not provided for the safety of victims' animals because they lack the statutory authority to do so. This bill is the result of a very broad and diverse coalition of people. You'll see letters from the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance and the Oregon Chiefs of Police in strong support of this bill. We would urge you to support the bill and pass it on for a full vote. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Emily?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Emily Davidson. I work for the Investigations Department at the Oregon Humane Society. Again, we're not affiliated with any local or national organization. Given the documented cases where women or victims of domestic violence choose to remain in that situation instead of leaving their animals behind, and the number of times that our investigators out in the field do encounter those exact situations, I encourage you to support this bill.
Thank you very much. Questions for either of the two panelists? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on 616? Not seeing one. We're closing our public hearing on 616. And what we're going to do now, I have a couple of people that are here on 906, and one of them appears to be Mr. Brown. Where are you located? It says that you're 100 miles out.
Washington, D.C.
All right. Let's go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 906.
That's more than 100 miles.
I'd say so. Mr. Brown, why don't you come forward, and Peter Dressler? Why don't you all come forward? Counsel, give us the overview.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 906 requires removal of personal information from used copy machines prior to sale or distribution. It makes a failure to do so an unlawful trade practice.
All right, let me just put on the record, I understand that both of you signed up in a position of against. I believe this bill was originally filed by the Rules Committee, pre-session filed at the request of Senator Morissette, who is no longer within the legislature. So just want to put that on the record. Gentlemen, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dennis Brown. I'm Vice President for State Government Relations at the Equipment Leasing and Finance Association, ELFA, as was mentioned in Washington, D.C. We represent companies that finance commercial leases of equipment. As mentioned, I am here to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 906. Under Senate Bill 906, everyone except the end user of a copier who places privacy information on the copier has responsibility for what the end user places on the machine. Our members have no retail stores, we have no inventories of equipment, and we don't even see the copier before it is leased. We're simply financing. Furthermore, technology, now standard on copiers, automatically erases information placed in memory thus making this legislation unnecessary. To cover those issues, I turn to the gentleman next to me.
Thank you very much. Thank you for traveling out.
Oh, yes.
And I hope you have enjoyed our liquid sunshine.
It has been interesting.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Peter Dressler, a branch manager with Pacific Office Automation, headquartered in Beaverton, Oregon, and I'm here to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 906. I've had the good fortune to be employed for over 25 years by Pacific Office Automation, which has become the largest independent copy machine dealer in the United States. We are a locally owned Oregon corporation, which 25 years ago was a company with less than $5 million annual revenue, and we've grown to a sales and service company with yearly revenues in excess of $135 million. We employ 300 people in the state of Oregon and 610 employees company-wide. The owner and founder of our company, who lives in Oregon, has steadfastly refused to sell out to any of the out-of-state holding companies or foreign-based copier manufacturers who have direct sales operations in this country. We are located in Beaverton, Oregon, as I said, in 130,000 square foot sales, service, and distribution headquarters with roughly $8 million inventoried locally. Pacific also has 16 sales and service offices located across six western states. I believe this bill is before the committee because of the publicity generated by a CBS News story. The evening news segment chronicled an individual who purchased four used copy machines from a New Jersey warehouse and proceeded to extract sensitive information off the hard disk drives of the machines. The stated message of that story, that today's copiers are, and I quote, storing an image of every document copied, scanned, and or emailed by the machine. This news story has caused a lot of heartburn for a lot of people in our industry and business people as a whole. The story broadcast by CBS about copiers was misleading and misrepresented the facts about what is stored on the memory of a copier. After the story ran and my phone started to ring with calls from concerned customers, I did two things. First, I contacted our manufacturers for clarification of how images are managed by the equipment we service. And second, I asked one of my field network technicians to replicate the exact steps detailed in the CBS story on three different makes of copiers. My technician came up with very different results. Our results were backed up by engineers from the manufacturers of the equipment that we tested. Simply stated, because of the features of current copier equipment, images are left stored on hard disk drives of today's copiers only if you use that copier as an electronic filing cabinet. Let me explain why this legislation is not necessary. Current models and models going forward from our major manufacturers have encryption built in, as well as the ability for the end user to push a button on the equipment at the end of that equipment life when the copier leaves their office, thereby erasing any sensitive data from the hard disk drive. We agree there may have been some weaknesses in older equipment, 2005 time frame and earlier, but because the average life of an office copier, which is approximately 36 months, the majority of these machines are out of the field. Of the ones left in the field, only half of them utilize hard disk drives. The other half use random access memory that is erased the minute the machine is turned off or unplugged. So the number of machines that are really of any concern would be a very small number when looking at the total number of copiers in the field. In addition, our contracts state the following to the end user, and I quote, "You are solely responsible for securely removing any data that may be stored on the disk drives or other memory media of the equipment you are returning." This legislation invites trial lawyers to bring suit against our entire distribution chain when, in fact, it is the user who makes a decision to store data.
I'm going to have to redo my schedules on these agendas. I mean, today is Michigan an Attorney Day. All right. I'm going to stop you there.
Yes,
I've
sir.
Got one person has a question, Senator Dingfelder, and then I have about eight people on another bill I want to get back up here to do testimony. So thank you very much. Your points were well received. Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have to say that it's yet another day. I'm glad I'm not an attorney on this, on this committee. However, and good to see you again, Dennis. I just want to mention that Dennis I worked closely with the chair on a bill in 2007, the computer recycling bill. And
thank you, sir.
Good to see you again, and thank you for your assistance with that. And actually, this does relate a little bit to that, because one of the issues that we dealt with in great detail was in our recycling bill for computers, mm-hmm. was about deleting information on CPUs. And I'm hearing it's sort of a similar type of issue, mm-hmm. when copiers are being sold or reused. And I'm just curious, there are actually three states I know that require the recycling of copiers. Dennis, I don't want to get you nervous, we're not doing that yet, but certainly it's a similar issue. And so I'm curious if you know how the other states, if you don't know this off the top of your head, maybe you can get back to us, how you're dealing with those states' legislation. It's probably more a question for you, Dennis, where you have copiers that are coming into recycling facilities, because that's one of the things that we're finding. You know, what happens to old copiers when they're done? And commercially, we know that a lot of times you'll have contracts as part of the procurement contracts, but for individuals, there are individual and small businesses that are either reusing or recycling their copiers. So I'm curious what you've done in that instance. It sounds to me like this is more of an issue of the past, that the new technology, what I'm hearing is that it's actually deleted, mm-hmm. So it's not on there for the future. So my question is, what are you doing for older copiers? And if you know, for those three states that do require recycling of copiers, if you've dealt with that in that legislation?
Well,
that was a long-winded question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I had to preface it.
Yeah, you did.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dingfelder, first off, as was read in the lease agreements, it clearly states the customer has the responsibility for removing the information. So on the older copiers, to start with, that's where the contractual obligation lies. On the newer machines, as has been said, it's not an issue. Encryption is standard. Senator, regarding your question about electronic recycling, California, for example, would be one of those states with electronic recycling where you would see copiers in there. The older copiers, if the customer so desired, they could contract with that recycler to swipe that hard drive. That would be, I think, a succinct answer.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Any other questions or comments?
No, that was like three questions.
Yeah, it was. Wait till we get back to the next bill, your bill. All right.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Comments, questions? And was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on 906? Not seeing him, well, we'll close that public hearing. Gentlemen, again, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and reopen the hearing on Senate Bill 778. And, Council, we did not have the overview, so if you could just go ahead and put that on the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 778 requires facilitators of income tax refund anticipation loans and refund anticipation payment instruments, which I'll call refund loans and instruments, to be licensed by the State Board of Tax Practitioners, which I'll refer to as the Board, requires filing, publicly posting, and communicating disclosures directly to the consumer, both verbally and in writing, authorizes the Board to specify form and content, certain disclosures by rule, requires licensee to arrange refund loan promptly after consumer applies and to deliver such loan within a certain time once approved by the lender, prohibits licensees from requiring taxpayer to obtain refund loan or instrument in exchange for filing the taxpayer's return electronically or in exchange for a reduction in any fee charged for preparing or filing of same, prohibits licensee from facilitating refund loan for which annual percentage rate calculated as required by terms of the measure exceeds 36%, prohibits licensee from deviating from certain disclosures, prohibits licensee from facilitating loan that lender secures with or arranges to have repaid directly from proceeds of the tax refund consumer receives from the state treasury, prohibits licensee from facilitating collection of delinquent refund loan, prohibits licensee from directing any portion of the amount consumer pays toward the refund loan to payment of fees for check cashing, credit insurance, or other goods or services unrelated to preparing and filing tax returns or facilitating refund loans, prohibits licensee from taking or arranging another's taking an interest in property of a consumer other than proceeds of the consumer's tax refund as security for payment of the refund loan, defines its terms, punishes violations of this Class A misdemeanor with maximum 1 year imprisonment, $6,250 fine or both, becomes operative January 1st, 2012, declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you very much. We have nine people left to testify. I said we're going to be 2 minutes. That's going to be basically we have another couple matters we need to take care of. Senator Dingfelder, since this is one of your bills, if you have anything else you'd like to add.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I probably said it all before, and I'm making up for my time on the last question. However, I'm hoping that I think I saw Patty Whitney Wise. I'm hoping she'll be coming up and saying something on behalf of the Hunger Relief Task Force. She signed up?
She is not signed up at this point. So let me do this. I have two people that have checked the box or marked the box that you live over 100 miles. Sarah Holtzclaw, do you live how far away?
Do you?
Where?
Ben.
Oh, come on up. And then also Kelly Ford, also checked the same box.
Sorry, not over 100 miles away.
Okay. Then what I'm going to do, why don't you go ahead and come up. Let's see. That's Sarah. And then what I'd like to do is go ahead and bring up Sheila Warren and Angela Martin.
And, Mr. Chair, Patty Whitney Wise did submit written testimony.
Okay.
On behalf of Oregon Thrive, so thank you.
You bet. All right. I hate to do this, but you're going to be limited about 2 minutes. If you have written testimony, please don't read it, but summarize for us.
Thank you. Chair Brzezinski, members of the community, community and committee, Angela Martin with Economic Fairness Oregon. Let me point out a few things about Senate Bill 778. First off, there are three primary players in this industry. We have the lenders and the bankers. The brokers are facilitators. Current law requires that any broker or facilitator be an Oregon licensed tax preparer. 778 does not change that. Of course, the third player are the customers. Recent U.S. Treasury report gives us great in-depth look to who those customers are. Young, low-wage workers, and primarily recipients of the earned income tax credit. As a matter of fact, 64% of individuals who take out a RAL are EITC recipients. We've heard much about what 778 would do. I would add one thing to that list to clarify. Senate Bill 778 would regulate refund anticipation checks. These are the up-and-coming product. It is a temporary account set up to receive the taxpayer's refund. The fees for all of the services are deducted from that, and the remainder is returned to the customer. This does not speed up the delivery of their tax refund. I'd like to spend the rest of my time explaining what 778 would not do. First off, it would not regulate banks or lenders. Second, it would not ban tax refund loans or refund anticipation checks. It simply speaks to the additional fees that a facilitator adds on. It does not speak to the actual offering of those or the bank charging fees. The facilitator could pass those fees, the bank charges, on to the customer. 778 would not require an APR calculation for anything other than the bank loan. It speaks to requiring disclosure of that APR according to federal truth in lending regulations. It also sets the time period for which the APR calculation would be measured.
I need you to, Angela, wrap up. It's been 2 minutes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Sarah, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Holtzclaw. I work for the Partnership to End Poverty and represent over 60,000 people living in poverty or on the edge of poverty in Central Oregon. I come today to support Senate Bill 778 and protect the working poor in my region and throughout Oregon. In this support, I will make three quick points. First, Senate Bill 778 is about protecting our most vulnerable consumers through transparency. Low-income taxpayers are often intimidated by the tax preparer. Not only do they not understand the nuances of taxes, but they simply are intimidated by their requirements and by the tax preparer who knows more than they do. Low-income taxpayers use their refunds immediately to pay rent, utility bills, car repairs, money that goes directly into their local economies. And these are often delayed expenses, so they're looking for their money quickly. Unfortunately, the mixture of that intimidation and that desperation for the money creates a reaction of just sign on the dotted line. This is the reaction that 778 is trying to avoid. Secondly, regardless to the recent administrative rulings of the IRS, where there is that desperation, there will be refund products. The working poor is big business across this country, and the combination of the earned income tax credit and the potential for refund products has been the primary engine for storefront tax preparation industry. Oregon is progressive in our payday loans, as said earlier, but the refund products are not, that though those refund products are considered predatory, they're not included in the past legislation. They will continue, refund products will continue and are continuing to exist and will likely morph into something else because there is profit in it. Profit takes advantage of the person's situation. As I said, the working poor is big business. My third point, as Angela said, this SB 778 is not intended to put a burden on the tax practitioner, but to offer information to the public and to the user of these products who are by far low income. The spirit of the law is to offer a point of comparison to tax filers so that they can understand the financial consequences of the fees being offered, not unlike the plain sight, plain language disclosures required by credit card companies and banks. In closing, we encourage you to pass this bill, a do pass recommendation. As stated in my written testimony, a markup would be held. I would suggest an additional change. Where refund anticipation loan is mentioned, I would replace that with refund anticipation product. As seen at the H&R Block website, when refund loans are phased out, refund checks and other refund products start to grow in its place. By replacing the word loan with product, it will cover future business practices. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'd be happy to answer questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Sheila.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Sheila Warren, and I'm a volunteer at the Urban League of Portland. I'm the founder of Portland Parent Union, and have a relative who has, I would say, a victim of the RAL process and all of the RAC process. I remember the relative being someone who was very surprised from the fees that affected them after they received their money. They didn't know a lot of hidden fees. I am here to share some thoughts for consideration as you deliberate the SB 778. Tax preparation protects the most vulnerable taxpayers, a constituency that typically earns less and fares a harder road in meeting basic day-to-day needs for their families and communities. The State of Black Oregon report published in 2009 revealed that the median income of black-headed households was less than two-thirds that of white households, a gap that remained unchanged since 1990. Recent data shows that this gap has indeed grown. Unfortunately, predatory lending has worsened some of these disparities. African-American borrowers are twice as likely as white borrowers to receive high cost, high interest loans, and most likely to have faced foreclosures in current economic climates. Nationally, we have recently learned that of the mortgages originated between 2005 and 2008, African-American households had the high foreclosure rate. Debt is one of the leading causes of foreclosures. African Americans and other communities of color have experienced an unprecedented loss of wealth in recent years. To allow many of these families to fall further into debt through a lack of regulation and tax preparation practices is a lost opportunity to help Oregon's hardworking families. People who qualify for federal and state, and some of this, I can finish, stop there, because some of this was repeated with the other two ladies. I can also talk about many national institutions and regulatory agencies such as the IRS, JP, Morgan Chase, as well as three federal bank regulators have already taken steps to eliminate inequitable practices in the refund and anticipation loan industry. It is time that Oregon echo these efforts and make the statement that we will tolerate inequitable lending practices. The Urban League of Portland supports this bill because we believe that this bill would help to protect hardworking Oregonians by prohibiting add-on fees for RAL and RAC products. I urge you to support SB 788 taxes. The tax. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Questions? Ladies, thank you very much for giving your testimony today. I'm going to call up the Matt Marquis and Kelly Ford next. Excuse me. I guess that's just getting ready. This is a break. Everyone wake up. We're now changing sides here.
I thought he was out of order or something. I don't know.
The new use of the gavel.
The pro, now the con. Okay.
Competitors. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing H&R Block today, speaking in opposition to Senate Bill 778. The bill, as you've heard, really goes after three different things: refund anticipation loans, refund anticipation checks, and the posting of tax preparation fees. You know, H&R Block worked very closely with you, Mr. Chair, several years ago to develop a very strong disclosure law that we have on our books today. It's my understanding from my client that these are still the strongest disclosure law in this area in the nation. We think the disclosures are working well and don't need to be changed. As far as refund anticipation loans, H&R Block does not offer the product this year. There are three banks that continue to offer the project. It's my understanding that the FDIC has issued letters to all three of those asking them to leave the marketplace. Two of them have voluntarily said absolutely and has submitted exit plans. The third is going through a separate process, but it sounds like after this tax season, all refund anticipation loans will no longer be offered across the nation because of the FDIC. As far as the refund anticipation check, it's kind of a misleading term as far as how it's described. What this is when somebody goes in to get their taxes done, and if the tax preparation fees are $100, let's say, and they don't have $100 to pay, there is a fee to extend that until the until your tax refund is brought forward. H&R Block charges $32.95. This fee is strictly for setting up a bank account so that that tax refund gets deposited. H&R Block gets paid, and so does the person seeking their tax refund. This bill would take that fee, which is strictly a bank fee in our case, and tie it into an interest rate and cap that interest rate at 36%. It does exclude federally chartered banks, but it's interesting that it puts the 36% interest rate cap on the facilitator, not on the bank, so that in this case where the feds say this is definitely not a loan, we're not lending any money, it would still tie a 36% interest rate to it. So it becomes somewhat confusing to the consumer when they see a Truth in Lending Act or disclosure that says 0% interest rate, and this would say something different. As far as posting fees, it was covered earlier. Senator Whitsitt asked some great questions. I do just want to say that, you know, through H&R Block's website, a tax filer that makes over $50,000 can still up to, I think it's $58,000, excuse me, can file their taxes for free online. And also this year at H&R Block, people seeking to file a 1040 EZ in office were allowed to file those for free this year as well.
I need you to.
Yeah. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kelly Ford. In the interest of disclosure, I am a lawyer, and I'm also a Liberty Tax Service franchisee operating two tax offices in the Beaverton-Aloha area. I want to address myself to some of the specific practical realities if the bill is passed in its current form, and to that end, remark that Senator Whitsitt's earlier question about the manner of the composition of the 36% cap is correct. As I read the bill, Section 4 clearly requires that all fees charged by the lender be incorporated within the 36% cap. This tax season, and my office issues refund anticipation loans, we do them on less than 2% of our tax returns. And in this tax season, Liberty Tax Service and Jackson Hewitt are the only tax providers, to my knowledge, anywhere in the country that are offering refund anticipation loans, and that's because the only bank that's really doing it is a state-chartered bank out of Kentucky called Republic Bank of Kentucky. They have one product. It's a $1,500 refund anticipation loan. They charge a $29.95 setup fee. They charge 36% interest on an average loan duration of 10 days. That's $16 and change. Because the Internal Revenue Service, between the last tax season and this tax season, announced that they would no longer inform tax preparation firms and the bank whether or not the IRS was going to intercept a refund, the bank started underwriting the loans. They no longer had assurance of collateral by receiving the refund. So they also this season charge a $45 credit fee. So 45 and 30 is 75, and the interest charge is 91. My firm, not my local firm, but my national franchisor, charges a $20 fee in addition to that. It is an extremely expensive product, and that's why I'm here as a reluctant opponent. But the bill would eliminate refund anticipation loans in Oregon because the only fee under the bill that could be charged would be, in this example of a $1,500 loan, would be the $16 interest charge. That is 36% over 10 days. No lender, certainly not Republic Bank of Kentucky, which has the only game in the country, is going to set up a refund anticipation loan for $16. Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you all very much. All right. We have Alex Burkey.
Burke.
Okay. And Sybil Hebb and Rick Bennett.
Sure. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alex Burke, and I'm a legislative aide for Representative Tina Kotick, who's the chief sponsor of this bill. And she's asked me to read her very brief testimony into the record, but in the interest of time, I'll just ask you to please read the testimony, and also on the back is a bill summary.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the good representative giving us written testimony. Sybil.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, also in support of Senate Bill 778. I'll be brief. I echo the comments of the consumer advocates before me. From the Law Center's perspective, we're concerned about access to justice for low-income people. We're also concerned about trying to resolve issues that we view as further trapping people in poverty. And refund anticipation loans, we think, are set up in a way in which consumers don't understand what they're getting into. They're paying a high cost for borrowing what is essentially their own money. It's a low-risk loan for the lender and a high cost for the consumer. We want to make sure we're in support of the principles of making sure that consumers know what it is they're getting into. So the disclosure pieces of the bill are very important to us, and the policy around ensuring that consumers have that information is important. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. Very briefly, AARP looks to a number of principles related to our public policy on consumer protections. Just to make note of just a couple of those. The marketplace must be transparent and give consumers the opportunity to make informed choices related to services and goods. Contracts, advertisements, sales practices, and so forth should not confuse or mislead the public. And the marketplace must make available to consumers complete and accurate information regarding the goods and services they purchase. And information should be communicated clearly in plain language to help consumers understand their risks, rights, and remedies. We think these principles that I've mentioned are very much in keeping with Senate Bill 778, and for that reason, we support the bill. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions? Comments?
Mr. Chair, I have a quick question. Thank you. Sybil, I was wondering, do you have any information? We heard from the previous speakers that Rawls are being phased out, which, you know, I'd like to get more information on that, which I will be following up on. But do you know, as far as refund anticipation checks, because I didn't necessarily hear that, do you have any data that you can share on that, please.
Chair Posonsky, Senator Dingfelder, I actually was speaking earlier with Matt just before the hearing started. I don't think I understand the distinction between a refund anticipation check and the loan, so I need to get further information about that, and I could be certainly happy to follow up. We do see that there are companies that are no longer offering these services, but they're still very much present in the community, and where they are, I think customers don't understand that they have alternative means to get their refunds for free in just about the same amount of time, and so that's the concern that we're worried about.
Mr. Chair? Thank you, Sybil, and thank you, Senator Dingfelder. I just happened to pull up an explanation of this that maybe will clarify. Hopefully, it said that what used to happen is that the IRS would receive the electronic return and tell the preparer whether or not the customer is going to receive the refund or it's going to be held to satisfy outstanding debt. But apparently, the IRS is now receiving the electronic tax return but not telling the preparer whether the consumer will actually receive the refund or if they're going to withhold any of it. So the taxpayer preparer doesn't know if the taxpayer is actually going to be getting all the refund. So it just changes the risk analysis, I believe, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. All right, thank you all very much. I have two other people, one that signed up but wanted to be included, Robin Johnson, and then I have a Robbie Johnson, or is that one and the same? Okay, so either Robin or Robbie.
I'll come as Robin.
Okay, we'll go with Robin.
And Mr. Chair, I just pulled up H&R Block's website, and refund anticipation checks are the first thing that popped up on the website. So.
Checks in the mail.
Yep.
Go right ahead.
Thank you. Chair Posonsky, members of the committee, my name is Robin Johnson. I'm the Community Advocacy Coordinator for the Oregon Hunger Task Force and Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 778. The Oregon Hunger Task Force and Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon view economic stability for families and individuals as the most effective way to permanently solve hunger in our state because we view hunger as an income issue. Hunger continues to affect too many Oregon families with children, seniors, and individuals who struggle to get enough money to pay their basic living expenses and still have money to buy food. We know that 1 in 5 Oregonians need the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program each month to buy food, and 1 of every 2 Oregon school kids qualifies for free or reduced price meals at school. Therefore, a primary goal of our state's 5-year plan to end hunger, which I've included a copy of the executive summary with my comments, is to increase economic stability for families, communities, and the state. And this includes a strategy to reduce unfair and predatory lending practices, such as refund anticipation loans and checks. So I'll leave it at that and ask you to help protect families by supporting Senate Bill 778. Thank you so much.
Robin, thank you. Hang on 1 second.
Okay.
Are there any questions?
And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Sorry, I didn't read that part.
That's all right. We'll hold you to it if there are any.
Okay.
I don't see any, so thank you very much for coming forward and giving your testimony.
Very good.
Anyone else who did not sign up for 778 that wanted to come forward? Not seeing anyone. We're going to close the public hearing, and we're going to go ahead and work. We got 3 bills for work session. We're going to see if we can get those done. Open a work session on Senate Bill 63.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 63 was previously heard on February 3rd. It has no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral. This is the state border parole post-prison supervision bill that conditions release in persons who were previously supervised back to the county where they were previously supervised. There was a -1 amendment that was received to exclude juveniles, so the condition would not apply to them.
All right, so we do need to adopt the -1s.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 63.
Senator Cruz moves the -1 to Senate Bill 63. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 63 as amended by the -1 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 63 as amended by the -1s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Chair will carry 63. And we'll close that work session, and we're going to open the work session on 386.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 386 has no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral. This is the bill that excludes property gifted to and held separately by one party to a dissolution of marriage from the presumption of equal contribution toward its acquisition that applies to marital assets.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 386 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 386 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So order. And let's see, on this one here, let's see. Senator Volamichi, will you be kind enough to carry 386?
Yes, sir, thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. We'll close the work session on 386, and we're going to open up the work session on Senate Bill 489.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 489 has no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, no subsequent referral. Previously heard on the 10th of March, requires the court to honor parties' written stipulations to continue certain domestic relations proceedings absent a finding that an injustice would result by clear and convincing evidence. It has a dash one amendment that requires the stipulation not less than 10 days before the hearing.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 489.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendment into Senate Bill 489. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 489 as amended by the dash one amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 489 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And on this one here. All right, so what I'm going to do is, Senator Dingfelder, why don't you be the carrier on 386?
I'd actually...
You don't?
That's okay. Did
you do both?
It's
okay.
Fine if she...
All right, Senator.
I was going to say, I'd take 489 as long as that's fine.
No, Senator Volamichi, you will take 489 as the carrier. We're going to close that public hearing, and we're going to carry over the following work session bills. It will be 385, Senate Bill 385 and 387 are carried over to Monday. Hopefully, we'll have the revenue statements, fiscal statements as needed. And with that, the last thing I want to do is I have Annalise Helm, who's with the Gilkey School Program. Annalise, come on up real quick. And everyone else who needs to leave and take off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a meeting I have to get to. So thank
Annalise,
you.
Come up here for a second and sit at the table. Annalise is one of the Gilkey students in the second tour. I wanted to welcome you. She's one of my interns for this week. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts that you want to share with us, but you need to say your name first on the record.
My name is Annalise Helm.
And today you got to see this, and yesterday you're anything that you want to report back to us?
Yesterday was really fun, and I got to learn a lot about how the Senate works on the floor, and that was really interesting. And I think I like the Senate better than the House.
With that, we'll close.